This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day, a day to educate about the epidemic and to remember the people we lost to it. The writer John Preston, who died of AIDS a couple of years ago, once said, "AIDS is not a gay disease. It is, however, a catastrophe for gay men." This catastrophe is being chronicled in a growing body of AIDS literature. Some of it is quite extraordinary. As literary editor Michael Denneny has said, the writers took on the job of sounding the alarm, mobilizing the community politically and spiritually, and delineating the shape of the disaster. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from some of the poets who have found words for the grief and anger that have left so many of us dumbstruck. Poet Mark Doty lost his lover Wally to AIDS nearly 2 years ago. They were together 12 years. Doty writes about their relationship in his new book of poems called Atlantis. Doty's earlier collection of poems, My Alexandria, won a 1994 National Book Critics Circle Award and was a National Book Award finalist. I spoke with Doty a year ago, and he told me that during the last year of his lover Wally's life, he had a viral brain infection which gradually paralyzed him below the waist.
Every few weeks, there would be something new that Wally couldn't do. Until quite late in his life, he would have trouble finding the word that he wanted, and after a while he was unable to feed himself. Each of these new limitations would mean a new level of loss. I came to feel that losing him was not an event exactly, not a moment, not a line to be crossed, but rather a gradual process.
You have a poem called New Dog about getting a dog for Wally when he was sick. Would you read the poem to us? But before you do, I think this is a new poem.
It is. It's one of the poems of this group that I found myself unable to write during Wally's life. And it was really only about 6 months later that I could see that the sequence I had written felt unfinished, felt unresolved to me. And what was missing was the kind of gesture toward life, towards ongoingness that he had made at a very late point in his life when just about a month before he died, he got very excited about adopting a new dog. Jimmy and Tony can't keep Dino, their cocker spaniel. Tony's too sick. The daily walks, more pressure than pleasure. One more obligation that can't be met. And though we already have a dog, Wally wants to adopt, wants something small and golden to sleep next to him and lick his face. He's paralyzed now from the waist down. Whatever's ruining him, moving upward, and we don't know how much longer he'll be able to pet a dog. How many men want another attachment? Just as they're leaving the world. Wally sits up nights and says, "I'd like some lizards, a talking bird, some fish, a little rat." So after I drive to Jimmy and Tony's in the village and they meet me at the door and say, "We can't go through with it, we can't give up our dog," I drive to the shelter just to look. And there is Bo, bounding and practically boundless, one brass concatenation of tongue and tail, unmediated energy, too big, wild, perfect. He not only licks Wally's face, but bathes every irreplaceable inch of his head. And though Wally can no longer feed himself, he can lift his hand and bring it to rest on the rough, gilt flanks when they are, for a moment, still. I have never seen a touch so deliberate. It isn't about grasping. The hand itself seems almost blurred now, softened, though tentative only because so much will must be summoned, such attention brought to the work, which is all he is now, this gesture toward the restless splendor, the unruly, the golden, the animal, the new.
Mark, where is the dog now?
Well, Bo's with me. At the time, I thought, well, we're doing something here that is a little bit crazy. There's a man in the house who's terminally ill, and of course his care was tremendously demanding. And it really did not seem like a reasonable time to adopt a 3-year-old golden retriever who was not particularly well-trained. And what happened after Wally's death was that I discovered that Bo was in fact Wally's last gift to me, because he became a wonderful presence in my life. A source of energy, a source of surprise, something to get me out of the house at times when I really didn't want to go, a set of needs that I could meet at a time when Wally was no longer there to have his needs met, and I didn't feel I could particularly pay a lot of attention to my own or even be clear about what my needs were. There was a dog to walk and a dog to feed, and a presence who needed my attention, and that was very important in getting me through a difficult time.
Did you ever have a sense of what you should be feeling and what you should be writing, only to find that you were feeling and writing things that were completely different?
Oh, sometimes I felt a kind of anger, a kind of helplessness welling up when I would sit down to write, which I did not want to confront. It seemed so necessary during Wally's illness to find ways to be in control, to find ways to manage, both to meet his needs, to deal with the many other people who were suddenly involved in our lives and in our home working to take care of him. And I felt I needed to be able to hold all that together at a time when I also very much needed to fall apart. And because writing is always an invitation to feeling, I would find that when I sat down to do my own work, I would often begin to unravel in a way that I didn't want to face. I think that's why for a long time I couldn't finish these poems. They would threaten to completely overwhelm me.
I'm going to ask you to read another poem. This is a poem about death. But I guess from the title, which is Bill's story, that this is not your story.
That's right.
This is told from somebody else's point of view. I'm not even sure it's about AIDS. So tell us something about whose story this is.
This poem is the story of a friend of mine who lost his sister to the epidemic very early on, early in the 80s, at a point when, of course, we knew even less than the little that we know today. So Annie experienced a sudden and wildly deepening episode of dementia, which at that point was completely not understood. The poem wants to tell Bill's story about the end of his sister's life, and also wants to think about the way that we conceive dying, the kind of I'm afraid sometimes all too convenient or easy ways we think about going into the light, the way we think about the experience of death, and how we as the living, as the caregivers, might assist in that, which I think sometimes becomes a little too simple. Towards the end of Wally's life, one of his nurses gave us a Xeroxed handout called How to Prepare for Approaching Death. And as well-meaning as that gesture was, it also completely shocked me to, in its kind of pomposity, you know, the notion that that someone understood what approaching death was like and the ways that we might prepare for it, as opposed to honoring the immensity, the unknowability of the mystery that confronted us. So I think that kind of concern is at the heart of this poem. It's also sometimes, too, you know, a wonderful escape to leave one's own voice behind and at least pretend to speak in someone else's. So this is called Bill's Story. When my sister came back from Africa, we didn't know at first how everything had changed. After a while, Annie bought men's and boys' clothes in all sizes and filled her closets with little or huge things she could never wear. Then she took to buying out theatrical shops, rental places on the skids, sweeping in and saying, "I'll take everything." Dementia was the first sign of something we didn't even have a name for in 1978. She was just growing stranger. All those clothes, the way she'd dress me up when I came to visit. It was like we could go back to playing together again and get it right. She was a performance artist. And she did her best work then, taking the clothes to clubs, talking, putting them all on, talking. It was years before she was in the hospital, and my mother needed something to hold on to, some way to be helpful. So she read a book called Deathing, a cheap, ugly verb if ever I heard one, and took its advice to heart. She'd sit by the bed and say, "Annie, look for the light. Look for the light." It was plain that Anne did not wish to be distracted by these instructions. She came to, though she was nearly gone then, and looked at our mother with what was almost certainly annoyance. "It's a white light," Mom said, and this struck me as incredibly presumptuous, as if the light we'd all go into would be just the same. Maybe she wanted to give herself up to indigo or red. If we can barely even speak to each other, living so separately, how can we all die the same? I used to take the train to the hospital, and sometimes the only empty seats would be the ones that face backwards. I'd sit there and watch where I'd been waver and blur out. And finally, I liked it, seeing what you've left get more beautiful, less specific. Maybe her light was all that gabardine and flannel, khaki and navy and silks and stripes. If you take everything, you've got to let everything go. Dying must take more attention than I ever imagined. Just when she'd compose herself and seem fixed on the work before her, Mother would fret, trying to help her just one more time, look for the light. Until I took my mother's arm and told her wherever I was in the world, I would come back, no matter how difficult it was to reach her, if I heard her calling. "Shut up, Mother," I said, and Annie died.
That's a really powerful poem about not following the rule book.
Thank you. It's hard for me to be sure now how much of that poem is really Bill's story and how much is my elaboration upon his story. I know that the imagination gets a hold of anyone's material and does with it what it will.
Were you with Wally when he died?
Yes, I was.
And did you feel like, well, I know what to do, I'll just do what I do, or were you fretting about what to do?
During the last month, it became clear that there was not a great deal of time left for Wally, at least not a great deal of time for him to be conscious. My great fear for him was that his paralysis would result in being, physically completely immobilized, but nonetheless aware, which did not happen. During the last few weeks, he was like a person who's had a stroke. Part of his body, half of his body, would not cooperate. He couldn't find the words he wanted. And during the last week, as his breathing began to change and as a kind of, a kind of sort of gentle, muffled ease began to settle over him, it was clear to me what was happening. And that last week was a very important time for us together. One of his nurses had wanted him to begin a rather large dose of morphine right around that time, I think on the theory that morphine makes it easier for people to die, and certainly can make it easier for the people around the dying person to deal with what's happening. But he wasn't in pain, or at least in no pain that he was expressing. And there was a kind of tranquility and ease in his face that made me want to resist that prescription. And I'm so glad that I did, because it meant that he and I had a week together that was a time of sitting together quietly, and sometimes I was reading and sometimes just looking at him, playing music for him that he liked, spending time with both the dogs, even the impossibly obstreperous new golden retriever, having the cats on the hospital bed with him that we had brought into our room, just being quiet together. He would sleep during the day, he would wake up and chatter or say nothing, he would laugh at his own inability to find the words that he wanted. He would ramble a little, and sometimes he would just lie very quietly. That time also meant that his mother and some of his brothers and sisters were able to see him before he died. And over the last 2 days, when his breathing changed very dramatically and it became clear that it was dying, that he was dying, it meant that the two of us could sit together and I could pay attention to that. It meant that when he could no longer move his head and no longer speak, I could keep myself in his line of vision and bring the dogs into his line of vision and see a reaction in his eyes that meant that, though he wasn't talking anymore, he knew that we were there with him. And it meant that that I could talk to him as he was going and be inside of that experience with him.
It must have been really good for you to be able to be there like that.
I can't imagine what it would have been like to lose him without being able to participate in that. Because there really was a kind of, oh, this is going to sound odd, there was a kind of beauty, a kind of power about watching that transformation. I don't know what I believe happens to us after we die, but I know now that it's something of which I'm not afraid, and that there is an enormous grace and dignity that becomes visible in us in that moment of our greatest extremity. And having seen that in him, I'm sure is what carried me through the first few months without him. You know, and then after a while, that sense of having been in some way blessed to be with him then faded, and I was faced with the plain old misery of grief and being without him. But the experience of being a part of that most, in a way, most profound moment in his life carried me through many months.
Mark, how is your health?
Oh, well, as far as I know, I'm fine. When Wally and I took the HIV test in 1989, he tested positive, I tested negative, and I haven't tested again since.
Well, I wish you good health. And
thank you, Terry.
Thank you for reading your wonderful poems for us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Mark Doty recorded 1 year ago. His new book of poems is called Atlantis. He has a memoir called Heaven's Coast, which will be published this winter. This semester, he's teaching at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. This is Fresh Air.